The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions? Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, I'm Gavin Graham, and I'm here with Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 p.m. in the UK. Each week with my global roster of fund managers, analysts and journalists, both in financial centres such as London and New York, but also on the ground in many of these emerging and frontier markets, we try to examine the various countries, clear up some of the misconceptions about these asset classes, and suggest courses of action for you, the listener. I spent most of my professional life analysing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money, and I can spot the differences between promising investments and the ones that are maybe not so promising. By emerging markets, we mean, of course, the BRIC countries. That's Brazil, Russia, India, and China, but also including such major emerging markets as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, and the Czech Republic. Today, I have reports on the Russia-Ukraine crisis, which rumbles on, Thailand, India, which has just had a major result in its general election, and Colombia, which sometimes is classified as an emerging market and sometimes as a frontier market. By frontier markets, we tend to mean the less developed emerging markets, although it does include the wealthy Gulf Emirates such as Kuwait. But it's countries in general like Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Panama, Slovenia, and Botswana. Today, I'll have a report on one of the major African markets in Kenya. Now, we have led with Russia-Ukraine over the last few weeks because it's been a major story, but also a major example to investors and to those interested in investing in emerging and frontier markets as to the volatility that attends investing in these developing countries and how rapidly the situation can change. Now, the Russia-Ukraine situation appears to be cooling down. The violence that was taking place in eastern Ukraine when pro-Russian forces were attempting to hold a separation referendum seems to have cooled down somewhat, but cooling down doesn't mean a resolution. To sort out what's happening and what it could mean to investors, I have our Russian analyst James Beadle on the line, who's been a regular on the show and been very helpful. This time it's from London rather than Monaco. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, James.
Thanks very much, Gavin. It's always great to be with you.
Thank you. So where do things stand right now? As I mentioned in the introduction, we had the attempted referendum on separation in portions of eastern Ukraine. And, of course, Ukraine itself has its general election coming up this weekend to actually elect a new government with the following the overthrow of the previous regime. It seems as though while we have plenty of action at the moment, we're not yet getting a lot of clarity. Would that be a fair description?
Yes, I think that's a reasonably fair description. It's perhaps good news that we have slightly less news over the last week or so. As you say, the referendum was held in eastern Ukraine, but it has very little credibility, and most people question the actual results that it produced. At the same time, Russia came out and voiced a much more nuanced approach to things. And so over the last week or so, really, I think we've seen, while Russia isn't stopping its support for the separatists, it's certainly being a lot less proactive with them than it has been, and it's being a lot more constructive towards finding a middle-of-the-road solution. At the same time, the Ukrainian side, they are also continuing to express that they are interested in it and willing to help with solving the genuine concerns that the pro-Russian side has. So we see both sides gradually edging towards some kind of resolution, but it certainly isn't over yet.
When we actually get the Ukrainian elections at the weekend, presumably it's going to be a large majority in favour of parties which favour closer engagement with the European Union and the West, while at the same time there'll be a substantial minority which would not be in favour of that course of action and would be in favour of closer ties with Russia. If we actually see the whichever party ends up winning it, making firm promises to those pro-Russian forces or pro-Russian element of the population that they will respect their language rights, they'll give them more autonomy. Do you feel that that might be the beginning of a possible solution which will lead to a de-escalation?
Yes, I think Russia itself has indicated that that's the solution that they will support. And I think that's the one which is needed. What they really will want to see is this very clear expression by the winning party, which will almost certainly be pro-European Union rather than pro-Russian. At the same time, it will be a slightly sensitive period between now and when the election does happen in, I think, 4 or 5 days. And in the immediate days after that, it's quite clear that some of the more aggressive separatists are still angling to try to disrupt the elections, and ballot papers are going missing and people are being threatened. So there are attempts to disrupt the election from happening, but it doesn't seem very likely that this will achieve enough to undermine the result on a national scale.
So is one of the reasons that President Putin perhaps is taking a more nuanced approach the fact that Russia is being downgraded by the credit agencies, that appears to be in recession, that the sanctions that have been imposed on some of his closest allies are starting to have some effect? Or is it merely that in his calculations it makes more sense to actually end up with some form of peaceful resolution?
Well, it seems to be a little bit of everything. I mean, the Russian side has never claimed that they wanted to take control of eastern Ukraine, and most analysts consider that that wasn't really their objective. And so if you look at it that way, perhaps their objective was really to make sure that the Russian side got a clear voice. And it seems really undebatable that the Russian side has managed to get a loud voice, if not always a clear one. At the same time, the sanctions and the economic situation remain a concern. And this week there's a very large annual economic event taking place in St. Petersburg, which will attract attention to some extent to the problems Russia is facing and to the isolation that has resulted from all of these events. And so there is an economic as well as a political interest, I think, on Russia's side to sort of scale this back a little bit and try to get economic factors back on the horizon for global investors.
Which leads us neatly, James, into the actual effect on the financial markets of all of this. I know and you've been at pains to reinforce the point that if you'd actually bought in the day after the big sell-off in Russia on the takeover of the Crimea, you'd actually be somewhat ahead of where you were, although obviously we're still down 10-15% for the year. If there were to be a closer focus on the economics and some resolution on the Ukrainian situation, which names might investors start to look at? Everyone knows that Russia is really cheap, and obviously one of the reasons it's cheap is one of its biggest stocks, Gazprom. The gas utility is about, what, 2x cash flow or something like that. What would your advice be to investors looking at Russia? Does it make sense to start with companies that appear to be really cheap, like Gazprom?
Well, certainly I wouldn't change too much from what my position was before. And yes, that is to focus more on the exporting companies. When you look at Gazprom, they finally managed to sign an enormous strategic agreement with China to provide energy for many decades out, and I think the value of the deal is something like $400 billion. And so it's certainly a reason to think that exporting companies can enjoy this weakened ruble and continue to generate positive cash flow. Of course, the risks remain high, and I think that I continue to watch the Russian economy with some concern. We had some better industrial production numbers in the last week. But at the same time, it's clear that the Russian economy will do nothing like what we were hoping it would do this year. With that in mind, I'd be a bit more careful and avoid some of the retailers, even Magnit and some of the more westernized companies. I would steer clear of the domestic economy and focus on exporters, which are undervalued and in some cases paying good dividends.
Yes, would that be a sort of fairly good rule of thumb in terms of comfort with corporate governance? as far as Russian companies are concerned, if they're actually returning cash to minority outside shareholders in the form of dividends, does that give you as an investor some comfort that the management has some concern for that, for your well-being as well as their own?
Yeah, I mean, well, when it comes to corporate governance in Russia, one does tend to have to close one's eyes and hold one's nose and dive in and hope for the best a little bit. But at the same time, I would apply the same principle to any equities I buy. I look a lot at US market from our Russian clients at the moment, and I always look for dividends. I always look for companies which are using cash in a responsible way, whether it's to develop business or, and if they're paying back excess cash flow, then all the better for me. It's certainly a measure of responsibility by management, I would say.
That certainly is true, and it's a theme we've talked about on this program a number of times about the importance of dividends when investing in frontier and emerging markets, because it does mean that the company management does have some interest in its minority shareholders. With that, and with the with that focus on yield, with where the prices have settled now, would you actually change your outlook about saying you should look at Russia if, for example, it sank further into recession, if we actually had some concerns about capital outflows, which led to the ruble weakening off, which should be good news, but might be a sign of worries about capital flight?
Yeah, I think, I mean, if the economy does deteriorate in such a way, then I would definitely take a little bit of caution. I think what I would be looking for would be to see the reaction from the government, because if the government moves in a sense of saying, okay, the economy is struggling, we have to change the way that we function as a country, then this could be a great opportunity for investors to get in. On the other hand, if we see the vested interests managing to restrict any reform and development, then it would certainly concern me as to where things are going. So I would watch carefully if there's a recession, but I'd watch it more from an opportunistic perspective, I think.
Okay, James, well, that's pretty clear. And again, thank you very much for the insight you've given us as the situation has developed at warp speed almost over the last 2 to 3 months. But I think it's fair to say that your advice to focus on the exporters with hard currency earnings and obviously with the dividend has certainly been good advice. I'm sure we will be back to you, but perhaps not quite as frequently in the future.
Well, in the best ways, let's hope that that's the case. Let's hope things settle down and profits continue to roll in a more steady fashion going forwards.
Excellent. Thanks again, James.
Thank you very much, Gavin. Have a great show.
Thank you. Thanks. That was our Russian analyst, James Beadle, who was on the line from London rather than his usual base of Monaco. But again, James has been very correct in pointing out that one should not look at domestically oriented companies in Russia simply because of the slowdown exacerbated by the sanctions brought about by Western powers due to Russian actions in the Crimea and in Ukraine. We'll have to wait and see what happens with the Ukrainian elections coming up in approximately 4 days' time. Just before we go to the break, when we are looking at Middle East and North African markets, it's usually countries like the United Arab Emirates at one end of the scale or Nigeria at the other, but most people don't focus too much on Morocco. Obviously, most people tend to remember Humphrey Bogart's famous lines from Casablanca, but it is 70 years plus since that movie was made, and it wasn't too realistic a picture even then. What's happening now to Morocco? Why has it been downgraded from emerging to frontier market status? All of these questions can find some answers in the current edition of our new publication, the EFMI newsletter. We try to actually give some insight into, to look behind the figures for some of the major emerging and frontier markets and what's happening there. If you'd like to get more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. You can buy it immediately at the discounted price of $94.99 by going to www.emergingfrontier.ca/newsletter/buy. When I come back for the break, we'll be talking to a fund manager based in India for a look at what the recent win by the BJP party in the general election means. Please stay with us for that.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Our article in the program today was about Russia, as it has been for many of the previous weeks, given the rapidly changing situation with Ukraine and Russia itself. China's economy, is it on the verge of a hard landing, or will the government be able to steer it through? Brazil has the World Cup of soccer coming next month, and concerns about whether or not infrastructure will be ready. With all of these developments in other BRIC countries, India has somewhat slipped off the radar screen, which, given that we've just had the biggest defeat for the Congress Party of India, which has effectively been the ruling party for the world's largest democracy for most of the 70-odd years since it became independent, is obviously very big news. To talk about that with us, we have Peter Curley, who is on the line from Mysore, India. Peter is Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Officer of DMS Funds, which has two India funds, a NASDAQ India Mid-Cap Index Fund and a NASDAQ India Bank Index Fund. And Peter's on the ground to tell us what's the effect of this major election is going to be. Welcome back to the program, Peter.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Not at all. It's a pleasure, and delighted to be talking about India with you, because this obviously is very big news. In the general election, Narendra Modi's BJP party won 282 out of the 543 parliamentary seats, more than the 272 needed to form a government, so it doesn't need to be in a coalition. And it's the first single party majority, I think, since 1984. Is that correct?
I believe it was 89 when there was a sympathy. Yeah, with Indira Gandhi when she was killed. But you are correct. And in fact, with the BJP, with some of their allies, their count went from 282 to 334. So it's a massive increase.
And obviously a massive rejection of the Congress Party, which has certainly not covered itself in glory in the decade it's been in power, which has been disappointing to a lot of observers, given that there were some good quality people in charge of the finance department and the like. Was that more a reflection of the attractive program put forward by the BJP and Mr. Modi, or was it more frustration with the infrastructure bottlenecks, the corruption, just the incredible length of time it takes to get things done in India?
Well, I think it depends upon who you ask. If you talk to people who are Congress allies or supporters, they will point to the fact that Congress did a terrible job. And if you ask people who supported the BJP, they will point to the fact that Narendra Modi did such a great job as Chief Minister of Gujarat. In fact, he instilled what they call the Gujarat model, which he's considering taking and implementing in the entire India. But I think that what was great about this election is the fact that it's the first election in India where the apathetic middle class, about 400 million of them, decided it was time to remove the government because they viewed them as an impediment to their moving up the ladder. And they became actively involved. And I think what was really, really appealing about Mr. Modi, Namo as they call him over here, I mean, he's taken on superhero status in this country. And that was the fact that he came from humble beginnings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, India's a very, very caste-ridden society. And the fact that he beat that and reached, you know, he was, and he'd been ridiculed for the fact that he was so poor once upon a time that he and his father sold tea on at a railway station, on a roadside stand. And he's worked his way up to now being, you know, the Prime Minister of India. And so it's actually, I talk to taxi drivers, I talk to the common person on the road, and they identify with him. And the mood is euphoric. And I'm getting caught up with it too, because I was a big BJP supporter, because they're free market capitalists, which is what I am. So it's great. It's wonderful over here.
That's obviously very encouraging news, Peter, and I can hear the enthusiasm in your voice, because you'd characterize this election as a real turning point for the Indian economy back in one of your blog posts. Absolutely. In March. What would you expect to see happening in terms of removal of blockages, improvement in delivery of infrastructure, all the things that apathetic middle class, as you so aptly described it, want to see happen? Should we actually expect to see feet hitting the ground straight away and a major change within the next 100 days, 200 days?
Easily. He has already said, and I watched him on TV yesterday, when he became very emotional, actually, and broke down when he was nominated by his party as the prime minister. And he said, literally, that he's going to hit hit the ground running. And his maxim that he came out during the election was maximum governance, minimum government. And he means that. And
right.
The sectors that are going to do really, really well under him is infrastructure, okay? Because he made a point about that in the elections. But the fact that sanitary conditions in this country are horrific, and roads are, you know, forget about launching a rocket to Mars. I mean the roads, it's like a, you know, it's horrible. So he's making that a priority, infrastructure. So that sector was a definite standout, and everything that's connected to it.
Would that also include real estate in terms of housing and commercial building?
Yeah.
And then obviously that would flow through to the banks in terms of their lending to help support that?
That's correct. Yeah, as far as infrastructure is concerned, anything, and I've already picked out what stocks that I think are going to be winners in the next. And I think that beginning now, you're going to be starting. It's already started, because the possible election of Narendra Modi, you know, was built into the returns of around 17% this year on the indexes in this country. But I think you're now going to start a five-year bull run, a bull market in this country. And the sectors that are going to do really well, the ones you mentioned, banks, real estate, infrastructure, manufacturing, these are sectors, oil and gas, for instance, they're the ones that are going to be really do well. Because when it comes to oil and gas, there are subsidies in place, which he has said that he is going to remove, because he's more free capital than the prior government. Banks, you know, and of course the ancillary, the lending for mortgages, they're all going to do very, very well. One of his things that he wants to do is to build affordable housing for people. So I think this is going to bode really, really well for these sectors.
Well, as you said, India has done well already this year, partially in anticipation of Mr. Modi's win.
Yes.
At the same time, for a foreign investor, the returns have been eroded somewhat by the severe weakness in the rupee towards the end of last year. Now, the new governor of the Reserve Bank of India has done an excellent job, primarily, I think, by most people would agree, by being a conventional central banker and raising interest rates to stop that drain of capital. There are some reports that the rupee could appreciate to 57 to the dollar by the year end. I think that's from Nomura. Somebody else has 55. Would you agree with that? And would you think that might actually help?
He's got to be very careful. If I may go back to August last year, when he was named central bank chairman, I urged people to get back into the market, into the Indian markets, strongly. Some listened to me, most did not. And just the fact that he's there, I mean, the rupee is appreciated from 69 rupees to about 58.77, I think, today, but it's about 15% rate. The problem is this, that he cannot afford, on one hand, to have a very strong rupee, because then it'll hurt the export sector, of which the IT, by the way, would be the biggest beneficiary. And so if they have a very strong rupee, it's going to hurt that sector. So I think around 56, 57 is where he'll hold it. It's a toss-up. I don't think he's going to get, I know what Nomura Securities said. Other people have said it's going to go up to 55. I don't think so. I think he's going to hold it around 56, 57.
Well, as you say, Peter, obviously export industries would not want to have too much strength in the currency, if any, to make sure they remain competitive. You mentioned IT as one of the sectors that would be affected, but also presumably there's going to be other Indian export sectors, which perhaps with less government bureaucracy, less interference, we might actually see developing in a way that really hasn't been the case to date. Are there anything else apart from the obvious infrastructure, banking, real estate? Do you think, for example, that consumer goods are going to benefit from rising living standards, as lots of people hope?
Well, so far, the non-performing sectors have been healthcare, IT, consumer staples, and fast-moving FMCG, fast-moving consumer goods. So, yes, it is quite possible that with more people entering the middle class, that sectors like FMCG will go up in value. But right now, I don't see it. I really consumer staples and FMCG is something I would stay away from right now as well.
Well, that's pretty clear advice there, Peter, because, of course, a lot of people taking the longer-term view tend to feel that FMCG and consumer is the place to be because it's an obvious play on rising living standards, increasing workforce. But as you said, that's not where the action is at present, and it may take a while before those sectors begin to see some of the benefit. So to start to summarize here, Peter, you'd say people should be in India. The currency is not going to be a concern in the way that it was the last couple of years. And you should be focused on the things that will benefit from what Mr. Modi wants to do, like infrastructure, banking, real estate.
Correct. And I think a sector that actually will probably do very well, actually in India, the mid caps, okay, I think will rally very well. And have already started rallying. They're a high beta play. And because of that, I think they're going to make out probably higher than any other indices this year.
And, of course, you have a fund that's got exposure to that as well as a fund that's got an exposure to the bank. So presumably DMS is well equipped to offer potential foreign investors the appropriately targeted way to play this development.
Right.
Excellent.
Absolutely.
Peter, thank you very much indeed. And as I said, it's great to hear the enthusiasm that you have for this market because, again, it is a transformative election. As you pointed out, it was going to be. And we can all be very hopeful that we'll see good returns from India in the future.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to Peter Curley, Chief Executive Officer, Chief Investment Officer for DMS Funds, on the line from Mysore in India for the analysis of what the future might hold for that country. And again, it's interesting to hear Peter saying that you shouldn't necessarily be looking at the long-term growth of consumer income plays like FMCG, which for those not familiar with it stands for fast-moving consumer goods. In other words, it's drinks, it's personal care, it's food, it's cigarettes, it's all of those things which are small amounts of disposable income increasing, mean you can buy a lot more of those goods, and they tend to do very well when the middle class is emerging. But instead, Peter feels that it's going to be the ones that would benefit from government getting out of the way. So it's infrastructure, it's bank, it's property, and the like. It'll be interesting to see how that works out. When I come back from the break, talking of demographics, we're going to be looking at the demographics of Kenya with one of our regular contributors, Peter Merrick. Please stay with us for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
Game-changing technologies and strategies are transformational, exciting, and disruptive for a reason. They shake up your status quo. They get you thinking about new ways to scale, compete, and grow. They move you in amazing new directions. You're invited to Take Your Coffee Break with Game Changers on Thursdays at 7 a.m. Pacific Time, 10 a.m. Eastern Time for our special series on the future of business. Learn how you can become the transformational leader who takes your company across the finish line as you look ahead to the next breakthrough wave of innovation. The Future of Business with Game Changers, presented by SAP on the Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. As I was mentioning before the break, in various editions of this program, we've been looking at the demographics of emerging and frontier markets in an effort to determine whether a country's population could play a positive or negative role in its economy and therefore its potential as an investment destination. We've been looking at several African countries with our next guest, Peter Merrick, who's one of our regulars. Today, we're looking at Kenya. Peter is on the line from Toronto and how it to talk about Kenya and how it compares to other African countries. Welcome back to the program, Peter.
How are you doing today, Gavin?
Very well, thank you. So as far as Kenya is concerned, could you actually just give us and our listeners some feel for how big the population is and its age structure? Because that's usually where we start off when we're talking about the demographic dividend, don't we?
Well, the population of Kenya is approximately 45 million people. And you, under the age of 24, about 60% of the population is from, let's say, a baby to 24. And that's, just to put that in perspective, if I look at the countries that you and I live in, you live in England and I live in Canada, you can look at other developed nations, the average age of the population is anywhere from 40 to 48. So you can see the big age structure. The average age of the average individual in Kenya is 19. So it's a very, very young population, and it's saddled with lots of unemployment. About 40% of its workforce is unemployed.
That obviously is a concern as far as political stability and the like, and there were some fairly major riots, not this most recent election in Kenya, but the one before. Nonetheless, that does actually mean that should those people move into the workforce, there's obviously the ability to add to the productive capacity of the country pretty quickly. What does that mean for Kenya as an investment destination?
Well, when we look at demographics, Gavin, we're not looking at the next, let's say, 1-2 years, even the next 10. We're looking at generations. So if we look around the world, in the developing world, we have an aging population. And here in Kenya, we have a very young population that has the potential, and I would say the potential, to have a demographic dividend. And what that means is if they can put more money in education, healthcare, infrastructure, and become more focused on the rule of law and also focusing on trade worldwide, there's a great potential for Kenya because people are a resource and Kenya has plenty of that. However, if Kenya is not able to build infrastructure, educate its people and get them working, there is a huge potential because there's 40% of the population unemployed that there will be a demographic drag. And that's the opposite. That means where you're not able to harness human potential and there could be strife. Because what's quite well known is if you have a lot of young unemployed men or boys, there's a lot of havoc that could happen in a society, and we've seen that again and again and again. So if they're not able to harness it and get outside investment to help build their infrastructure, Kenya could be not a very safe place to invest.
Following on that line, Peter, is AIDS a major consideration as it is in some other countries, particularly in Southern Africa? Has that had any effect on, for example, the number of orphaned children and the need to provide care for them? Is it a potential drag, or is it not as much of an issue in Kenya as it is for some other African countries?
AIDS is an issue in Kenya. And one of the big issues that you have to look at is when you start looking at that younger population, you start looking at 60% of the population is under the age of 24. You start looking at the where are the adults. A lot have died of AIDS, and it's had a huge impact. The life expectancy in Kenya is in the early 60s, and part of that is there's a huge amount of people who are dying of AIDS. Six in 1,000 people have AIDS in that country. It's very, very high. It's having a very devastating impact on the country. But in the last few years, drugs have become more available to Kenya. They're becoming more educated. And again, education is the investment that needs to be made in Kenya. Education and infrastructure. And Kenya is, again, it has the potential. The world needs young people to fill, enter the workforce. And Kenya has that. They've got a high birth rate. They've got pretty well a high literacy rate. About 85% of the population are able to read and write, and that is something which is very beneficial for the economy. Now it's about harnessing it. So, Gavin, if we were to look at where someone might want to invest in Kenya, looking at the demographics and looking what needs to happen, I would say looking at international companies that partner with Kenyan companies in Kenya that help build infrastructure. I think that's going to be the focus for the next few years. By having proper infrastructure, Kenya has a great opportunity to harness its people. And again, every country that's ever done well has harnessed their young people, educated them, and had focused outward. And we've seen the biggest success happened to be China, and about 10-15 years later, you saw India doing that, and we can see what's happened in those countries.
Excellent, Peter. Thanks very much indeed for that. As always, we appreciate your input, and we'll be back talking to you again soon, I'm sure.
Pleasure, Gavin.
Thanks
to have a great day.
Thank you. Our thanks to consultant of demographic research, Peter Marrick, for that look at Kenya's population and what it might mean for its status as an investment destination. Turning now to Thailand, Reuters suggests that the turmoil in the country, where the military appears to have taken control, there's the possibility of civil war. This morning, Reuters was reporting that rival political factions would not agree to stop their process as crisis talks aimed at ending confrontation continued. So while the military has denied its surprise move on Tuesday amounted to a military coup, that nonetheless there are concerns that the situation could spiral out of control. There are a number of Thai stocks trading over the counter in New York, not as sponsored ADRs, but on the OTC market, and a number of them are quite sizable. So to find out what might be happening in that market and possibilities, we have Michael Yeo on the line from Singapore, who's a senior market analyst at the International Data Corporation. He travels to Thailand several times a year on research assignments and has just returned from Bangkok. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Michael.
Hi, Gavin. Thanks for having me back on the show again. Pleasure to be out here.
No, not at all. So it's a pretty confused situation in Thailand at present. How much real hope is there for a speedy resolution of Thailand's ongoing political crisis?
You know, Gavin, this is such a tough question, and I think we would all certainly hope that there is a speedy resolution, but there are really just so many factors in play at the moment. I really can't give an answer at this moment beyond maybe and hopefully. I think the best hope for Thailand now is that the military situation remains as it currently is, within this kind of military framework, which is in place apparently to keep the peace process going on and make sure the election process remains in place. And our hope is that the actual, there is a planned election soon, which is due in July. Our hope is that that can actually be held and that people can go to vote. Currently, that is now looking more and more unlikely due to this disruption. Just on another viewpoint is that I actually say that this martial law situation is not necessarily a bad thing. I think it has the actual potential to provide the third party in this affair, which is in some ways needed for some stability in order to get things moving in a clear direction and a faster pace. This martial law is actually in some ways has been welcomed by some parties who have stakes in the economy. I think I've heard some key figures from the tourism sector say that they actually welcome this state of affairs as they think that it can bring a quicker resolution to this this political turmoil that's going on in Thailand at the moment.
No, that's true, Michael, and indeed the Thai army has tended to see itself as the referee or the arbiter to step in when the squabbling politicians can't make up their mind. So it may well be, as some of the people you've been speaking to suggest, that with this could actually break the deadlock, the paralysis almost that's prevailed in Thailand as a result of the refusal of the opposition to accept the legitimacy of the rule of the previous government. Is Thailand headed into a recession as a result of this political paralysis? Is the economy doing well? What did you see when you were up there recently in terms of things like people in the shops, or is Bangkok's notorious traffic any better than it was?
I think this political unrest, we've actually seen there's been some real damage done to the Thai economy. We previously had forecasts of 0.4% for Q1 GDP growth. The actual figures came out recently, which show a contraction of 0.6% from a year earlier. Given the current situation, it is actually pretty likely that a technical recession will happen as Thailand continues to struggle with this unclear political situation. Some of the areas that we are seeing, which have a lot of exposure to this political situation, would be in things like consumer goods. Consumption in Thailand has been dropping ever since the unrest started. Consumer confidence was actually at its lowest back in Q4 2013. People in general in Thailand are uneasy and unsure this whole situation is playing out. Other sectors under play are automotive related. Thailand reported some of its worst annual automobile sales figures recently in the past couple of months, partly due to a change in government policy, but also likely in some part to the political turmoil.
So just to start finishing up here, Michael, in terms of those companies which are exposed to the effects of the turmoil, would the banks be amongst those, and also would tourism-related stocks like, say, Airports of Thailand also be vulnerable to this continuing uncertainty?
When you're looking at stocks, strangely enough, like I said previously, stocks which are involved in consumer goods would be under threat. Strangely enough, there still are some odd performers during these times of uncertainty. I've highlighted this stock before in a previous edition, but Tibet, which is a major producer of beer and spirits, has been a pretty good performer over the past few quarters and has been holding out well during this political situation. Strangely enough, it gives evidence of the fact that people just love to drink whatever's happening. looking at other stocks such as financial institutions, well, actually financial institutions such as Dankel Bank, K Bank, Kronzi Bank have actually been gaining in value, even against the background of what's happening in Thailand. The most recent weeks have seen dips, but I think that most of these banks are pretty good business models, pretty good fundamentals against which to place longer, such as longer medium-term bets.
Okay, Michael, well, that... it's encouraging to see that even with all of this uncertainty, there are some sectors which are holding up, at least as far as their stock market performance is concerned. And it may well be that, as always, the stock market is being an anticipatory mechanism. It's actually reflecting the bad news towards the end of last year. And now perhaps it's starting to look forward to some resolution to this. Thanks very much indeed for that insight on Thailand. Sure, we'll be back to you soon.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks so much. That was Michael Yeo of IDC in Singapore for a look at Thailand and the political crisis there. When I come back for the break, I'll be taking a look at the money flowing into Colombia, which also has an election coming up too. Please stay with us for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
The way we do banking today continues to evolve. No longer is it just brick and mortar locations or traditional bankers' hours. Today, banking is 24/7. It's in the home. It's on the go. It's digital. Tune in to Breaking Banks with Brett King for a look at how traditional banking as we know it has changed due to a loss of trust, changing economic conditions and consumer behavior, government involvement, and of course, technology. What does it all mean? Listen every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the final segment of Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Just before we go to our final segment, in various editions of this program, you'll have heard me and some of my guests discussing the difference between active management and passive management. Obviously, active management, where a fund manager is actually picking individual stocks as opposed to tracking a market capitalization weighted index in a passive fashion. We have an analysis of both actively managed funds and also the passively managed ETFs in our new publication, the EFMI newsletter. If you'd like more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. And now on to Colombia, and Rupert Stebbings is on the line from Medellin. He's Managing Director of Equity Sales at Valores Bank Colombia. Welcome back to the program, Rupert.
Hi, Gavin. Good to be here.
Thanks. Now, your bank has recently issued a report suggesting that foreigners remain the top net buyers of Colombian equities, although that may have lost some momentum recently. But the locals are a little more concerned about the potential outcome of the election, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is due this weekend. Is that foreign buying likely to continue regardless of what happens in the election?
Yeah, it's interesting you should mention just before I came on about active and passive management. Colombia has been subject of a lot of passive inflows over the last 2 years. You could argue constantly we see program orders coming in. So I think over the last couple of months we've seen very much active managers getting busy, or getting active if you want. They've been the biggest net buyer in the market. I mean, this year basically they've been the biggest net buyer, although volumes have been lower. The local pension funds have been largely on the sidelines, but overseas we've seen names like Grupo Sura, which is the monstrous, financial entity here. Ecopetrol has picked up a lot of active business, and Davivienda, the bank. And, I think foreigners in general see the bigger picture. You're talking about, experienced fund managers. They've seen elections, over the decades. They always seem problematic, maybe up close, but from a distance. They've seen it all before, and I think they tend to keep their eye on the ball. They look at where the good assets are, long-term growth prospects. And here we're really facing an election between two or three candidates, arguably, whose economic policy is almost the same. Whereas the local funds, they're kept out of the way. They're not too sure what to do right now. So they've been net sellers, for the last couple of months. And they're really just taking some off the table, just waiting to see what develops over the next couple of months.
Does that apply to individual Colombian investors as well as the local institutions, or are they actually showing more interest in increasing their market share?
No, I think I think market share is a misnomer, because people here don't really. The thing is with the market in Colombia, you cannot see what anybody else is doing until after the event. So, you can't see who's buying or selling at any point in time. So it's only after the information is released for the next month that you can actually see. I mean, the market share pickup, I think Colombia also benefits greatly from the fact that there's so much implosion around the region. I mean, obviously ongoing concerns in Brazil about, the outcome of the election, whether Dilma will stay. I mean, we've got Venezuela as a neighbor. We've got Argentina, Bolivia. Chile is arguably the most reputable country next to Colombia. So we do benefit, I think, greatly from, lack of confidence in other countries from the foreigners. Whereas locals don't tend to invest overseas. Maybe in ETFs, maybe in fixed income products, but they very much concentrate on the local market. And, they see the local problem only.
And in terms of what's happening with the election, it's been characterized by a fairly negative tone, and that, as you said, both parties are probably pretty similar in terms of the economic policies, which in a way is a big result in that it's not really a concern that there's going to be an introduction of Latin American socialism or anything of the kind. Nonetheless, is there the possibility of unhappiness if the other side gets in? Would that lead to any violence or major uncertainty, or is it really just like most elections, there's a lot of sound and fury, but it doesn't signify too much?
The key issue here is that the two candidates, Zuluaga and Santos, who's the current president, who will almost certainly make the second round runoff, they both come from the same cabinet during 2006-2010. So economically and in terms of business, they really don't differentiate. Now, the problem that is causing is they're looking to differentiate from each other. Now, we have an ongoing peace process in Havana. We had the third stage announced of the five announced last week, which was the narcotics. I mean, we have an agreement on that. Now, Zuluaga stated publicly that the day he takes office, if he wins, he will suspend the process and look for the guerrillas to lay down their arms immediately. Santos is 100% on the peace process, and this is leading to an extremely negative campaign. I mean, it's hard to put it into words how negative it's become. On one side, we have allegations of tapping, phone tapping. On the other side, we have allegations of dirty money in the campaign. And locals are really, quite depressed about the whole situation. And it really, the market was down 1.2% yesterday. Even though the U.S. was slightly weaker, the main problem here is that the locals are just looking at two politicians behaving like school children, to be honest. And it's a problem. But I think the key thing for investors is, if you want to buy an asset here, nothing's going to change. Nothing economically, they're both monetary politicians. Inflation is still the goal. I don't think long-term investors need to worry about it, but short-term, locally, obviously there's a lot of noise. In reality, we still expect Santos to be returned for another 4 years, which would, in my opinion, be the best outcome for the market. Some would argue he doesn't deserve another 4 years. So I think of the candidates currently on offer, I think continuity would be what Colombians are looking for.
And so just to finish up here then, Rupert, once the election is out of the way, the good underlying fundamentals of the Colombian market should once again become more apparent to investors. And if, let's say, that we do have continuity and Santos wins, are there any sectors that might benefit from that continuity in government?
Well, we have continuity. We have a high prospect of a peace agreement this year, maybe even a Nobel Peace Prize for Santos, which is talked about here quite publicly. If you have a peace process, obviously there's a lot of ins and outs. There's a lot of stuff that goes in that way. But long term, obviously, that's a tremendous boost for the country. And I'd imagine overseas investors will be much happier with a peace process under the belt. That said, the country is already, you know, trucking on for 5% GDP this year. Inflation is well under control, even though it spiked a little recently. We have rates at 3.5%. If you compare that with other countries, that compare that to Brazil, where inflation is moving up rapidly, where rates are much higher. I think the fundamentals are still very, very strong. And I think foreigners see that. I just think it's the locals who are just, it's in their face literally what's happening every day. It's in the press. You can't avoid it. And I think they're just a little unsure. And if we look back historically in the market in Colombia, this happens every 4 years. The market gets very uncertain and tends to pick up very quickly afterwards.
Okay. Well, that might well be the cue for people who are thinking about it. Colombia is a possible investment destination to be aware of that and maybe to begin committing some money. Thanks again, Rupert. That's been very helpful. And we'll see what the outcome of the election is and the outcome for the Colombian stock market thereafter.
Okay, absolutely, Gavin. Good to speak to you.
Thanks. And thanks to Rupert Stebbings of Valores Bank Colombia on the line from Medellin, telling us about the potential for the Colombian market to start to perform once the uncertainty of this election is out of the way. Today in the program, we've covered Russia and Ukraine, India, Kenya, Thailand, and Colombia. And next week, I'll be back with our global roster of contributors for another series of reports from the emerging and frontier markets. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emmett. We are the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets, now available in English-speaking markets around the world through electronic bookstores such as Amazon, and also Frontier Markets for Dummies. We're also the publishers of the EFMI newsletter I've mentioned during the program. This radio program, our books and the newsletter mean we believe we're one of the leading sources of information about emerging and frontier markets investing. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks. Please join us again next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.